So without further ado, we're going to move on over to this interview with philipjanderson.com. Philip J. Anderson, double L in Philip. He is a business cycle forecaster who's consistently defied the bears with largely accurate forecasts. And it's nice to have someone on the show who can talk about things from a different perspective. You know, I'm very much a bear. I'm very pessimistic about the future of our current economic framework. Well, Phil Anderson has a different slant on it. This week on The Renegade Economist, we're with Phil Anderson from Economic Indicator Services, investigating the power of stock markets and this amazing money printing cycle we're on. Philip, you keep saying things are onwards and upwards from here, and you keep being proven right on many fronts.
I'm of the view that people should look at the whole economy in terms of a real estate 18 to 20 year cycle. The cycle's been present in the US since 1800. I'm astounded that more people don't see this. And for a long time now, every time the US has had its downturn, the Fed, and this time we've got Ben Bernanke in charge, he's a very good student of history, he knows the Depression quite well, the Great Depression of the 1930s quite well. Every time the US has had a downturn, they've simply resorted to the printing press. And the Fed, it can print as much money as it wants. It really can, and it will continue to do so until conditions improve. The printing that we've got at the moment, yes, all right, it's been a bit larger than perhaps we might expect. The numbers are bigger, but you know, as a percentage of the whole economy, really, it's nothing new. It's been happening. It's the same money printing went on in the very early 1990s, and again, it was happening in the very early 1970s. So I think they'll print as much as they want. The other side of the coin, though, of course, is once things start to improve, what everybody forgets, and things are improving, as I said they would, the Fed can decreate that money just as well. Now, I don't profess to understand the process exactly, but they can do that as well. So I don't think there's a great deal to worry about, I think, and that's being proven by the markets at the moment.
But every time it's rumoured that QE may be ending, there is some sort of correction in the marketplace, and it just seems like the share market is going so well, but the rest of the real economy is struggling along.
Oh, Carl, I'm not so sure about that. Yes, there's no doubt. It's clear there are a percentage of the US people, and as we know, everywhere around the world, that has, in some areas, a great deal of poverty and people struggling. You know, there's no doubt about this, and in an ideal world, which, you know, you're listeners, I'd hope, it would be familiar with the whole economics that you talk about. But leaving that aside, we know that there are great pockets of poverty. But, you know, overall, I happen to think, generally, the middle class in America and the middle class in many places, I think they're doing a little better than we think. And also, as regards US corporations, US corporations have an astounding amount of cash sitting on the balance sheet. I think the most they've probably ever had in the entire history of the US. I'm not saying that's always a good thing, and we know, of course, that US corporations can be heavily protected through government-granted licenses and the whole Congress bit, and yes, we know all that. But despite that, they do have a lot of cash sitting on their balance sheets. Apple themselves have $130 billion. Microsoft have something like $30 billion. Other corporations have similar amounts. It adds up at the moment to about $1.3 trillion sitting either mostly from these US corporations overseas, and they've got tax problems if they bring it back to the US, which they may or may not do, and the US may change those tax laws. But US corporations, as represented by the corporations on the stock exchange, they've never been so profitable. They have a lot of money sitting there. And I know there's Australia and other places, in the UK as well. When you put your money in the bank in the UK, as a deposit, the interest rate is zero. So there will come a time when some of that money is going to be better deployed. I also think you can see, if you can read the market okay, the US markets had a major low on November the 16th last year, and markets after that date have been on a tear upwards. The way I read the market, I happen to think that it was on November 16th and a couple of days afterwards that the ordinary mum and dad investors realised that they were beginning to miss the boat. They were able to see that what the Fed's been able to do, yes, it's printing great truckloads of money, but it has floated the system or refloated the system, and they came to realise after November 16th. Greece is not going to default. The euro is not going to collapse. You know, and as you know, Carl, I've been saying that for several years. And that's just history repeating, where people panic and they get worried about what's happening around the world, and they continue to read all the papers. When, if you have a look at the system behind it, we've seen that at every real estate downturn, where it's the same thing, where people panic and put their money back in cash, when really it's the time you should be bringing it out and making investments. I think after November 16, people in the US and around the world began to realise that they're behind the curve, they're missing the boat, and they should be back in the market. And that's the money starting to come back, and that's why the US markets are back pretty much at past all-time highs, back at the 2007 levels, because things are improving.
But if these major corporations have so many billion dollars on their books, and we've still got unemployment at around about 9% in America, it hasn't really flowed through to the people. There's money printing, it's gone in the stock exchange, boosted all the share prices of these companies. Why isn't this so-called trickle-down economics really filtering through?
Well, yes, I agree with that. I'm not suggesting we have a fantastic system. I don't think the system's fantastic at all. But I just try to read it from a point of view of an enclosed capitalist economy, where the land rent is privatized and allowed to be tradable, and the banks can create credit on this enclosed value. That's the system we've got. And when the Fed prints money, it's designed to refloat the system. It's designed to save the banks. It's designed to put money back in corporations' hands, and it's designed to save Wall Street. I'm not saying that's a good process. I'd like to see it changed. But for the moment, that's how the process is, and that's what I try to read. And it's exactly the same process that's been employed by Wall Street bankers and those in control in the US. It's been done every 18 to 20 years since 1800 in the US. What we've got at the moment is no different. In the beginning, it doesn't trickle down to those who should desperately be having, or those who can least afford it. But that's not what it's designed to do. And so the Fed and the reserve banks worldwide, they will refloat the system. They'll continue to do that. The Fed will continue to print money. The Fed will continue to keep interest rates low enough until they see that the US economy in particular, can withstand the recovery of putting interest rates back up, which they've got to go back up at some point, and the US economy can withstand a withdrawal of the so-called money printing. They'll just keep going on that until things are fixed.
So we've got the continual debt ceiling debates over there and how they're going to pay off all this debt. I also see up here on your bookshelf, The Great Depression Ahead, Harry S. Dent Jr. Now, how is the demographic story going to tie in with the debt ceiling, with all these climate pressures coming through? There's a lot of stress on the system, and at the moment the resilience is being printed, not actually made.
Oh, there's several things I could say about that. If you have a look at history and the way history repeats, after all the debt problems of the early 1970s, after the debt problems of the early 1990s, once things began improving and unemployment came down a bit and all the money printing stopped, people's focus changes. And when growth gets restored, people, they just have enough of austerity, and they have enough of all these packages that we're led to believe are beneficial for us, and they've just got to get on with their own lives and growing their business and earning more money and putting their kids through school. And things just start, I found when history to repeat from here, things will improve, people's focus changes, and suddenly you'll find, I think people are discovering now, that the big huge debts that we've all got, people begin to feel that they're affordable again. The worry that people have changes, and they start looking forward to, and they start to see that with the growth coming, that it's not such a problem after all, and then somehow some other problems seem to surface, which changes the focus. The second thing I wanted to say on that is demographics is a reasonable way of seeing trying to do some forecasting, but I don't think there's too many things to worry about as far as demographics go in the US. You know, they'll change when they want more people in, they'll change their immigration laws, and you'll get more people coming in, which will mean more demand for houses and the rebuying of all the ones that when they created too many in the first place. The third thing I wanted to say about that as well is it comes from one of the all-time great stock market operators, William Gann, W.D. Gann. And when you read some of his books, and it's in particularly in his book, 45 Years in Wall Street, and it's on page 114. And Gann wrote this book back in 1948, I think, or thereabouts, late 1940s. He made the comment that after every 18 to 20 year downturn, which he described in his book, as I've done, as after every downturn in particular, one of two things happens in the US, and this has been a constant theme of history. The US will discover some new form of energy, or the US will continue with its integration of new technology and the development of all forms of technology to lower business costs, and that's been happening every 18 to 20 years. After every downturn, we've seen the same thing. In the US this time, possibly first time in a long, long time, maybe not the first time ever, but certainly the first time in ages, first time in decades, we have the US facing the possibility of both. US energy costs are and will continue to do with this shale gas stuff, leaving aside the environmental concerns, the costs are going to lower dramatically. We are talking about a lowering of costs that might be anywhere between 50 to 60 to 70 to 80%. This is going to make US corporations competitive big time. To give you an idea of the difference, costs of gas in the US are coming down from $3 per whatever they measured in kilojoule or something like that. Costs in Japan for gas is about 16 or 17 kilojoules. It's five times greater. Once the US allow the gas to be exported, this is going to be a prodigious lowering of costs worldwide for energy inputs. Now, not only do they have the lowering of costs for energy inputs in the US, they've got this prodigious technology development happening. And, you know, let's face it, America produces much of what the rest of the world wants. They produce half the world's airplanes. They produce, it must be more than half of the world's computers. They produce enormous amounts of technology. This is going to hugely benefit everybody going forward. So you've got these two things that are playing out in the UK, in the US. This is going to allow, I think, a prodigious increase in performance in the US, and I think it will allow the recovery to take place. I think the recovery will be big time, and I think at the end of the day, and Carl, you know, as you know, and your listeners have got to start to appreciate the benefits of human progress ultimately in the end are taken by land price. And this is the huge benefits coming over the next real estate cycle. They're going to be capitalized into land price, and this is going to allow land prices around the world to stay high, and it's just going to be another cycle.
You're on 3CR's Renegade Economist. We're discussing the state of play in the world economy with Philip J. Anderson, philipjanderson.com. He is the author of The Secret Life of Real Estate and Banking, and has been on the show a number of times before.
I am super concerned about big private equity companies like Blackstone Capital spending some $100 million a week buying up houses. They've spent $2.5 billion in the last year buying up houses through nine different states in America. They're assembling a arsenal of new rental streams that they're going to then turn into a listed entity and floated on the stock market. And with this, they're wiping out the mum and dad investors, the small business type competition from these big players. And we're stepping closer and closer towards back to this serfdom scenario. And they've actually got a new brand name for it. They're calling the rent-a-nation, these people who are preferring not to buy because of all the risks, and private equity is stepping in to snavel up these millions of empty homes, boarded up homes, and slowly drip feed them to the market to bolster their bottom line, but at the same time constrict the spending ability of the people. And as we see through books like The Price of Inequality by Joseph Stiglitz, and starting to get some mainstream acceptance now that A, trickle-down doesn't work, and B, inequality, drastic inequality that we're seeing around the world doesn't, the multiplier effect doesn't come into play so much. And so from that, the whole economic growth cycle is slowed down by this inequality.
Well, Carl, I agree with all that. But the process is going to be no different. We have a system where the economic rent, as best described by David Ricardo, is permitted to capitalise into a tradable privilege, which the banks are then allowed to, by society, create credit upon. That's the system we've got. And until enough people get to understand where this system comes from, and until enough of people around the world, and certainly your listeners, until enough listeners can start to see that system will persist whilst we allow that economic rent to be captured in private property, that's just the system we've got. That's the nature of the real estate cycle. When you get to the bottom of the real estate cycle, when you start to recover, you know, all of the people that defaulted on their mortgage, they can no longer afford to buy. They then have to rent. The multinational corporations and the investors, they come in, they see that, they fill that opportunity by getting their by messing all of these old and the houses that have been overbuilt, all those everything there. They put that all together, and then they'll float these things on the stock exchange and put these houses back up for rent for people that could no longer afford to buy. That's the cycle. That cannot be that. The only way you can do anything about that, you can fight it how you want, but the only way you can do anything about that is for the people themselves to begin to understand where the real estate cycle comes from, and it's the capitalization of the economic rent. The only way you can stop that is to have that rent collected on behalf of the people, say by the government or through various real estate trusts on the listed on a stock exchange or something like that, and then that rent can be given back to the people by way of a citizen's dividend. Now, until the people wake up enough to start demanding that their economic rent, which they created in the first place, unless they start demanding it for themselves, we have a real estate cycle. It lasts 18 to 20 years. We get a boom and then we get a bust. And the way things are going at the moment, as I tried to describe with new technology and all the energy-related discoveries, unless the people come to realise how the system works and do something about it, we are going to get an improvement from here in the whole real estate thing around the world, and we're going to get then another huge boom 10 or 15 years later, and it's going to lead to another bust. That's just the way it is. That's just the system.
And so here we are, based in Melbourne. How are you seeing the Australian real estate market play out? Seems like it's all positive news in terms of the auction clearance rates here in Melbourne, averaging around about 70%, up from the low 50s this time last year. But yet we've got thousands upon thousands of apartments due to come through the system. We've got 97,000 hectares that has been rezoned residential over the last decade on the urban sprawl. The first homeowners have pretty well boycotted the market, down to 14.9% of all home loans last in the December month. So it is on a tightrope here, but it seems like that people are being told, you know, it's onwards from here.
Yes, well, all that's history repeating. I remember clearly in the very early 1970s when land prices had gone up so high, we had a bust after that because the developers could no longer afford it. Same thing happened in 1986-87 where land prices went up again so high, and then we had the bust. Land prices again been up far too high, and we've been due a bust. A couple of things I can say about that. Generally, Australia has the same cycle as the US does. It's the US that I've studied mainly. I found Australia to be about a year and a half behind the US. So I would say Australian real estate, I don't study it on a state-by-state basis, but as an homogenous around the country, probably another a year to go of sliding backwards in a way, and perhaps prices stable. But after that, I see things picking up once again. One of the reasons that's coming through, I think, is because of the whole commodity price wave thing, which has become obvious for people now, but 10, 15 years ago wasn't so obvious. I see commodity prices will be staying quite high. So generally it's just steady as she goes, really. And again, because the whole economic rent thing is capitalised into a price, we're just going to get another cycle, same as last time, same as time before that.
You've just returned back from a big investor conference in the Middle East, and late last year you were flown over to Singapore to speak at a big government-sponsored conference about these very issues. So Singapore seems to be an interesting point in case, and seems like we need to spend a bit more time looking at how they do things over there.
Yes, Singapore is an interesting place in the sense that Singapore is one of the few places in the world, Hong Kong do it as well, but particularly Singapore, where almost all of the land, I think, if not the whole lot of it, is leased to its citizens. So it's on a 99-year lease. That means that the Singapore government, by design, was created in 1965 from its birth, from when it went to a non English aligned. The Singaporeans and the Singapore government leases its land, which means they capture a part of, or a good deal of the economic rent. I think I have been forecasting, I'm on record as suggesting, I think within 50 years, I think Singapore will be one of the richest nations on earth, if not the richest. But that, even though Singapore does make steps or take steps to collect that economic rent, so for example, when new infrastructure goes in, and Singapore at the moment, the Singapore government are attempting to have an MRT or a subway station within 500 metres of everybody living in Singapore before long. You know, that all that stuff increases land value, and the Singapore government do claim some of that back, and then it goes into a sovereign wealth fund, which again, Singapore have one of the largest wealth funds for its people. So I think Singapore will do very well over the next 50 years. However, because they're only a small island state, and only a, particularly probably, you know, in world numbers, reasonably insignificant, just because they do that, it doesn't insulate them from the rest of the world, because Singapore is such a great trading nation. So if the rest of the world has its downturn, or when the US turns down, Singapore feels that, because the trade declines, so they're going to feel that in their nation as well. But Singapore's a model you could look to as regards how they treat their land and how they treat their rent. It's something I think, Carl, you and others could probably do more of, I think, over the long term.
And that is philipjanderson.com, philipjanderson.com, economic forecaster, and a regular guest here on the show, looking at the importance of this economic rent terminology, and a reminder that neoclassical economists tell us that it's only 1% to 3% of the economy and we should basically ignore it. We're saying, look, this is the money the monopolists make in their sleep, whether they're land speculators, whether it's Bernie Ecclestone owning the one license to run a Formula One Grand Prix around the world, whether it's MTR running our trains here in Victoria. These guys have a huge advantage over everyone else, and that naturally rising value of the assets they own is actually closer to 27%, and could act as a natural financial base to fund government. And from that, we can keep the right wing happy by reducing taxes on production and increasing them on speculation. And that seems to be the defining issue of the day and age. Alongside removing lobbyocracy, we've lost democracy. We've forfeited it to the same people, to the one percenters who basically can push the buttons, can push the diversions however they want, so that
the mainstream don't pick up on this fact that there is a natural system of financing government. And if you just think about Melbourne, think about whatever city you were in around the world. If nobody lived there, how valuable would the land be? Everyone move back in, all of a sudden there's a competition for prime locations, and whoever is lucky enough to say they own this land will be delivered windfall gains, whether they work, sleep, or watch the telly. So that's what we're talking about. This is basically the source of simplicity for the modern day life. It does assist us on the sustainability path and the efficiency path. So I look forward to being with you here.